Hello, and welcome to Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with historian Doug Hocking, who's written a book about the Apache Wars around the time of the U.S. Civil War involving Cochise. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Doug Hocking, author of The Black Legend, George Bascom, Cochise, and the Start of the Apache Wars. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, glad to do it, Chris.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject? And you can go all the way to the beginning, as far back as you want.
As far back? Well, I grew up on the Jicarilla Apache Reservation in north central New Mexico. And that it marks the start of my interest in Apaches. Living down here for almost, the last 30 years in Cochise County, you know, I'm right where everything happened, and I took an interest in it. It's a much discussed affair, Bascom's meeting with Cochise. But as I got into it, I started looking at the primary documents. And I found out that the story that they told was entirely different than the story that's in the secondary sources. The secondary sources, the popular histories, say Bascom went out with 12 dragoons 4 months after a boy, who grew up to be Mickey Free, was taken by Apache raiders. He found a group of Apaches at random. The group was led by Cochise. He blamed them for taking the boy for no reason. Took them hostage, but was so stupid that he forgot to take away Cochise's knife, and he cut his bonds and cut his way out of the tent, escaped, took his own hostages, and then Bascom refused to make the trade without the boy. In a fit of pique, Bascom hanged his remaining hostages, who were Cochise's relatives. And this started Cochise's hostility to the United States. Prior to that, he'd been our friend. He was the always peaceful. He was the chief that guarded the Overland Mail. In fact, he raided the Overland Mail and he raided the Americans, but that kind of got forgotten. In the peculiar circumstances of Arizona in 1861, July, the army left Arizona and went to the Rio Grande to fight invading Texans. This left the miners and without protection, so they left. The ranchers and farmers with no one to sell their produce to and no protection from the Apache, they left as well. It got down to where Arizona was 100 people living in Tucson, a handful of sturdy, rugged Mexicans, and the rest of them were people on the run from committees and vigilance in California who had nowhere else to go. Yeah, and that's the way it was through the Civil War. And after the Civil War, Southern Arizona was slow to recover. And in 68, a captain, Reuben Bernard, who had been a first sergeant of dragoons in 1861, was asked by his commander, "What happened? How did this happen with Cochise?" And Bernard saw his opportunity and made up a story that is, you know, ridiculous at every part, but it became history. He made up a story with himself as the hero. He was the sergeant leading the dragoons. He told Bascom not to hang his prisoners. Now, he pleaded with him, and Bascom court-martialed him. You know, we know from the record that Bascom went out leading 54 men of his own company, Company C, 7th Infantry. Bernard was assigned 90 miles away to a Dragoon unit. And, well, it kind of goes from there. And, you know, and I begin to document all the facts of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins to look more and more like, eventually, Bernard's company was there, but I don't think Bernard was with them. Hmm. I have some evidence that says he was on leave in Tennessee at the time.
Hmm.
He forgets little things like his commander was there.
Uh-huh.
His commander was senior to Bascom. By the time the affair was over, the commander was senior to Bascom.
Hmm.
And was in fact the one responsible for the hanging. But the hanging occurred because Cochise had slaughtered and apparently tortured the hostages that he took.
Hmm.
That Bascom was willing to make the trade without the boy, but Cochise was only willing to give up one of four hostages. And Bascom said, hey, I've got to have all four.
Hmm.
That ought to confuse just about anybody, right?
No, I think it flowed. So how do you break down the book? You know, do you go chronologically or what? How do you hit the different aspects of this story?
Well, I start the story around 1856, which is when we moved into the Gadsden Purchase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it became ours in 54, but we didn't send troops until 56. And then I watch what happens with the troops and with the people who were here, how they lived in both cases, who they were, how they dealt with the Apaches. And after doing all that, then I start with the raid on Johnny Ward's farm that took his stepson Felix, who later becomes Mickey Free, and 30 head of cattle, and how Bascom follows a trail that seems to lead to Cochise. And then just take it step by step through everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And finally I end by going into what the real causes of war were. Not a lieutenant offending one chief.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, the war was coming. The Apaches saw the army leave and said, we've won.
Oh.
We had one writer who made a great deal of the wrath of Cochise and how this was all Cochise's revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I break down what Apache revenge looks like and how Cochise's revenge was over in a few months. And he went into an entirely different mode, a very interesting one for an Apache. He actually took on the army on several occasions where the Apache normally avoided the military. He took them on in pitched battles, the Battle of Apache Pass.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not his revenge. You know, he killed a handful of people, and then he went over to this, hey, the army's gone, I'm not letting them come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time the war was over, nobody was authorized to make peace with Cochise till 1872. And then my prior book was about that. Tom Jeffords, friend of Cochise.
Mm-hmm.
And how the peace hinged on their friendship and trust.
So you're really immersed in this subject then, because you've written a number of books, right?
I have, I've written what's it been now, 6 published, and I'm working on the 7th, and I have to turn it in December.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the 7th book is Terror on the Santa Fe Trail.
Mm-hmm.
Kit Carson and the Hickory Apache.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that one deals with, it's funny that it's the same period that Kit was involved with the tribe when he was actually protecting them most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That they got dealt a couple of dirty deals where we had one lieutenant who was responsible for attacking a friendly camp without provocation and got his head handed to him.
Mm-hmm.
He lost 22 men, 36 wounded, was out of ammunition when the Apache broke contact. Their loss was 2. He tried to ride into their camp, which was up a steep hill and just got himself into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, the Army looked at it and said, we've been embarrassed, we've got to go after them.
Oh.
They went after them and completely broke their power.
Mm-hmm.
Pursued them for 2 years. It all happened before the Civil War. Nobody's ever heard of it.
Yeah. So how did...
Imagine two troops of cavalry almost wiped out. It's like Custer's last stand.
Yeah. It sounds like many fewer Native Americans.
Oh, yeah, but many fewer. The lieutenant claimed there were 300, but there weren't that many Hickory Apache warriors. So he looked at that and said, oh, I better add some Utes. And there's no evidence that the Utes were anywhere nearby.
Mm-hmm.
All indications are that there were between 60 and 100 Hickory warriors
mm-hmm.
present against 60 dragoons.
Mm-hmm.
And they just utterly had the advantage of the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant was a damn fool to go up that hill. I was out there with a friend recently.
Mm-hmm.
And what fun trying to find the place. It's way up in the Embudo Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So
you think you found the precise location, or just in general you found it?
I found the location of the Hickory camp.
Mm-hmm.
And there were enough things on the ground that I was able to positively go, yep, this is the spot.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
And also from the other histories and the first-hand accounts, it was clear that this was the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's the end of a spur coming off the hill.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a natural spot to make a camp and survey the area.
Yeah, it's an excellent spot for defense for a camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hickory also said that they were there making pottery. Their economy depended upon this micaceous pottery,
mm-hmm.
which they were selling to the New Mexicans. Because the mica in the pottery distributes the heat so the pots don't crack, and you can actually put them on the fire.
Oh, wow.
So that they were valuable in metal-poor New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they need two things, a clay source and a mica source. And one of the things that I found all over the ground was that they'd imported mica to the site.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And it's like, oh, you know. Here it is. Yes, they were here making pottery.
Wow. So did they choose the camp because they were aware of some danger, you know, the defensive position, or was it just a natural spot for them to work in and stay safe?
It was a natural spot for them. It was close to their friends at Picaris Pueblo, and it was close to sources of mica and clay.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the place to go to make pottery.
Now, did considering the tactics that the Americans and the Native Americans used against each other, were these battles basically, you know, you stumble upon each other and then you make do as you can with the terrain and whatnot, or were the Native Americans better at fighting than the American soldiers?
Well, they knew the terrain better.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the Army is hunting for them, trying to catch up, pushing their horses hard, so they're arriving tired. And when you're being pursued, you get to stop and choose the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the Apache were good at choosing terrain for their camps where they'd be safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at this camp, and they'd have known anyone was coming. Long before they got there.
Hmm.
And then they've got to come up, and it's what I like to call a fingernail climb. You're coming up on hands and knees.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Lieutenant tried to charge up with that with his horses. Got partway up the hill and found the horses couldn't go any further, so they had to dismount and leave the horses behind. He left them with the horse holders, and they continue in two platoons up the hill. get to the camp and find it deserted, and then there's a cry from below. They're stealing the horses! So they head back down the hill and find themselves in a bowl in a pine forest, so the Indians are coming up behind the trees and lobbing arrows in on them.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers can't even find them.
Oh, so they didn't even have rifles? It was just bow and arrow?
Well, the Apaches had a few rifles, but very few.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers were armed with musketoons,
mm-hmm.
which is a shortened musket, a very short-range weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And with horse pistols, which were single-shot cap-and-ball pistols.
Wow, those weapons don't sound made for fighting in that kind of area.
No, they were at a disadvantage. The Apaches had an advantage on them of range and volume of fire,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that the Apaches were able to make use of what I would call indirect fire. Lob it in high, and you've got a compact group of men that's going to hit something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, the what you talk about in the book, considering the soldiers at that period of time, how did they carry their own food, or did they do a lot of foraging when they patrolled or went after the Native Americans?
It would depend on the type of expedition, the length of the expedition.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they were carrying food. You get the army out there. In some cases, you got whole pack trains with them.
Mm-hmm.
In other, you've got wagons traveling with them. Larger groups actually had herds of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something you exactly see in the movies.
But,
you know, you haven't got refrigeration. How do you keep your meat fresh? Well, keep it on the hoof.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're limited to shorter patrols, you know, living off pinole, cornmeal, and dried meat, and salt pork.
Mm-hmm. So how much do you get in the book? Is it, how do you break it down between the personalities and such, and, say, military tactics and operations and strategy and that sort of thing?
Well, I pretty much try to cover both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when I'm dealing with Black Legend, where I've got Bascom, whose personality I've come to know a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Come to know him as a nice young man who was kind of self-effacing.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up in the family of relatives because his father died and his mother couldn't deal with the children.
Huh.
So he grew up in that environment, and then you can see this in the others as they react to him. They like him. They respect him. He's bold, almost to the point of recklessness.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, I watch him making all the moves that he should as an officer and taking the advice of his NCOs. Who actually like him and defend him.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, Cochise, now I consider him the greatest leader the Apache ever produced. He's up there with Mangus Coloradus.
Hmm. Okay.
Cochise is able to handle large-scale tactics. He's, you know, the first Apache that starts to think what we might call strategically,
mm-hmm.
Of winning a war instead of just raiding. He knows when to walk away and he knows when to run. Yeah. But we watch him interacting with Bascom, and you can see some of the scars of previous dealings with the Mexicans, who had brought members of his elder brother and his father in for parley and then killed him. So here he is in parlay with Bascom. And Johnny Ward, the boy's stepfather, is the interpreter. And Bascom says, you know, I want the boy back. I want the cattle back. Coach East, who knows that everybody's been going by his doorstep coming back from raids, says, look, I haven't got him, but I think I know who does. And give me 10 days, I'll go get him. And Bascom, in his report, says, I told him, okay, you've got the 10 days, go get him. And at this point, Bascom is almost confused by what happens. Suddenly, Coach East jumps up, pulls his knife, and cuts his way out of the tent. You know, the flap is tied because of the wind, and he cuts the flap open, screams to his people, and runs up the hill. Now, he's run through a camp of 66 soldiers who don't have loaded weapons. The only way he could have escaped. Everybody remembers Johnny Ward coming out of the tent, pulls his pistol and fires twice. We've actually found both rounds. You know, found the bullets. You can see in his report that Bascom's a little confused. I told him he could go. We don't know what Johnny said. We don't know how Johnny said it. But he triggers a response in Coach East that is conditioned from what's happened in parlay with the Mexicans before.
Yes, maybe the interpreter said, "Hey, we're gonna. You're not getting out of here alive," or something.
Maybe the interpreter said, "You're our guest for the next 10 days." Or, hey, or the interpreter accused him of lying, or whatever. Johnny liked the boy, you know, and he was seriously concerned to get him back. So.
How much fighting was there between the different tribes? You know, I'm just trying to understand how Coach East developed his sort of military thinking, so to speak.
The Apaches, they did a little bit of farming. It was kind of an odd farming. They would plant someplace where they knew it would get wet during the summer and then go away and come back in the fall. They did a little bit of hunting, but game down here is scarce. They did a lot of gathering, but our weather is uneven. I don't know if you've ever been out here, but I stood on a hill one day and watched seven different thunderstorms playing around the valley. So we had places getting soaked and places that remained absolutely dry. So vegetable foods were erratic and couldn't be predicted. So the Apaches added to this. They were great traders. They brought in things from place to place that people needed. And when they found someone weak or when they were desperate for food, they raided. And they learned, you know, we're not going into whole terrain. We're going into raid. The whole point is to come out of this alive. You got to have good tactics to do that. And that's how they develop. I mean, you've heard how they train their children. Give a young boy a mouthful of water. Tell him to run to the top of that hill 5 miles away and back and spit out the water when you get here. Now, don't swallow it. If you swallow it, you got to do it again.
That'll build up endurance.
And it would certainly build up endurance. And then they had their own language, very much abbreviated, shortened language that apparently women didn't understand. That was just for men to use on the raid. So, and they looked at two types of raids. You know, one was a raid to get food, and the other was a murder raid. Somebody killed one of you, you went back and you got even.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So during the period, so in Black Legend, during the period of the book, what kind of weapons was each side using?
Everyone's armed with muzzle loaders, except for the Overland Mail people. Mm-hmm. They've actually got one of the first breech loading weapons, but it fires a paper cartridge.
Okay.
They were all percussion cap weapons. And even the sharps that the Overland Mail had, he lowered the breech, pushed in the paper cartridge, raised the breech, which cut off the back of the cartridge, exposing the power, and then you put a percussion cap under the hammer.
Okay.
Okay, everybody else is using rifles. The Army's got 68 caliber rifle muskets. They have just begun to get Minier balls, which are elongated with a concavity in the rear end. You can just about drop it down the barrel. But when you fire, the round expands and engages the rifling, which spins it and makes it accurate to longer distances. But you're still talking a muzzle-loading weapon. The Apaches have got some muskets that's smoothbore, shorter range, and some few rifles that they've captured. They're still using flintlocks. We've got the first revolvers, which are percussion cap weapons and take forever to load. You got to spin the whole cylinder and load each one separately, and then put a cap on the rear of each cylinder. And that, by the way, was one of the most powerful weapons of the day. Instead of one shot, you had six. And at this point, you know, the Apaches are just starting to get rifles and just starting to get muskets. There's talk in the newspapers at the time of how the Apaches have changed tactics, and instead of just raiding, they're coming around and sitting on the hill and waiting for somebody to go by so they can shoot him for target practice. They're, like I said, just starting to get rifles.
And,
go ahead.
And they were still using bows and arrows as well, or?
Bow and arrow and lance are still very much in use.
What are the ranges of the bows and the lances that they were using?
The bow, you can figure about 50 yards. The musket, you can figure about 100 yards. The soldiers claim with their rifle muskets they can hit out to 400 yards and more. And that gets interesting. So the Apache weapons are definitely shorter range.
And the lance, is it just for stabbing, or they didn't throw that at all?
No, it's for stabbing.
Okay.
They don't even use it much on horseback, you know, other than using it like a lance.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right. Okay. And how about the Apache clothing? Was it just for comfort and show, or was there any sort of element that protected them from any kind of attack?
This gets interesting, and it carries over in the weapons too. They had stopped using stone arrowheads, and they were cutting up barrel hoops to make metal points for their arrows. And a similar thing happens with clothing. They're wearing cotton clothing for the most part, except for their moccasins, which come right up to the thigh and have the Chiricahua have a peculiar raised peculiar raised sole that's turned up at the front of the moccasin, apparently to ward off cactus. And we have reports that going into battle, they will actually strip off everything except the breech clout. Which, by the way, is very wide and cotton. Yeah. Cotton's a lot more comfortable than leather.
Huh.
Especially worn as underwear, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And they switched over as soon as they could get it. But they will strip off the clothing, and I wonder if that wasn't because they discovered that when you're wounded in combat, some of the cloth is driven into the wound and will cause it to fester.
Oh.
So you're actually better off being without a cotton shirt. In Europe, you'll hear about people taking off their shirts before a duel. Either that or wearing silk for the same reason, because the silk won't penetrate the wound.
Now, was the American soldiers, were their uniforms made out of cotton?
Cotton shirt, woolen pants held up by braces, that's a cloth suspender, and a woolen coat.
Okay.
They're very hot.
So, if a bullet went into the cotton, then would it cause the same festering in the wound?
It would cause the wound to fester. And it took a long time for us to really catch on to that. Plus, part of the surgery of a wounded man, you get the bullet out, and then you go after that piece of cotton if you can.
So now, why would the shirts be cotton and the coats wool? I'm not familiar with the manufacture of those things.
Have you ever worn wool close to your skin?
I'm not... I think it's a little... It doesn't feel good, right?
It itches like mad.
Okay.
Cotton's much more comfortable.
Okay. But it can't get... But cotton isn't going to be as thick and good in colder weather, I guess?
Right. Well, it's... Yeah, the Army issued clothing thinking that the whole world was like the Northeast. It wasn't practical clothing for out here. And a lot of times early on, we do see the soldiers coming up with their own clothing with canvas pants and cotton shirts to wear in the field. Now, Basque's men would have been wearing wool because events are taking place in January and February. And they actually had about 4 inches of snow that year up at Apache Pass, which is not all that common here.
Okay.
They had a cold winter.
So now, as far as canvas pants, was that why wasn't that standard issue? What was the negatives with canvas?
I would say that wool held up better. You know, wool wears like iron. And we're talking about Army thinkers back in Washington, D.C., deciding what everybody's going to use and not the people out here in the far west.
So now the moccasins that the Apaches wore, what were they made of, and did they go up to the thigh to protect against vegetation? There is pretty, you know, like the cactus and the, you know, bush and stuff. It's pretty scratchy. You know, it can really tear your skin.
There is stuff here that will take most of your hide off.
Yeah.
The moccasins, the ones I've seen are deer hide. The soles are, you know, wherever they could find it, something heavier than deer skin. Cowhide works, and they were killing Mexican cows. I'm trying to think of what other animals, you know, buffalo, but we're not buffalo country down here. That's what most Indians would have used.
And what do they use to sew the clothes with? What kind of material, you know, for the seams and stuff?
Sinew.
Okay.
Which is, it's kind of the back strap of your muscles, that the stuff that pulls, contracts and pulls. And if you, I used to work with it when I was a kid. I could actually get it at the butcher shop. They give it to me for free.
Mm-hmm.
It will tear off in strips, in threads, if you like.
Okay.
The other thing is, we have a cactus down here, a succulent, agave.
Mm-hmm.
And the agave has a very, very sharp and very, and it's got a point that stands up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually snap that off the green part of the agave and strip it right off the side of the leaf and come up with a thread a couple of feet long. That's another source of a thread and needle.
Wow, okay. But is that the only kind of needle they used, the cactus point, or are there other materials for needles?
There are other materials. Bone needles, and you use a bone needle with an awl.
Mm-hmm.
Either early on sharpened bone, or when you can get it sharpened, metal.
Mm-hmm.
And you make your holes first with that, and then push your bone needle through. That bone needle's so big that you're going to have problem with the leather.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I ask all this because, you know, on the American side, you know, they have their, you know, you get your provisions and your supplies and all that, you know, from official sources, whereas the Native Americans and the Apaches are living off the land for the most part. So it's interesting to just see how these two sides sort of equip themselves, you know.
Plus, down here, you know, Fort Buchanan, where Bascom was assigned, if you look on a map, it's over near Sonoyta.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Buchanan is the absolute end of the supply line.
Mm.
Supplies are coming in over the Santa Fe Trail to Fort Union, which is the major depot for the Southwest. Fort Union is about 50 miles east of Santa Fe,
mm-hmm.
on the other side of the mountains. And from there, they've got another 550 miles to go to get to Fort Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they've already come 900 miles from Missouri.
Mm, okay.
And we're talking about coming by, you know, ox-drawn wagon until they get to Fort Union, and from there you're looking probably at mule-drawn wagons or pack mules bringing it the rest of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So they have chronic shortages. It's fun reading the reports from Captain Richard Ewell.
Mm.
I don't know if the name Ewell means anything to you.
I'm familiar with his name.
You know, he was Stonewall Jackson's second in command,
mm-hmm.
in command of Jackson's unit at Gettysburg.
Okay, right.
Out here, he was a hero. He was our best Indian fighter. He was assigned to Fort Buchanan before Bascom got there.
Mm-hmm.
And listening him talk about his men being dressed in rags, not having enough to eat, I can't go out on patrol because I haven't got any ammunition. I've got 110 men, and I've only got 50 horses, and 12 of them are unserviceable.
Mm-hmm.
They are at the extreme end of the supply chain, having a hard time getting anything.
Hmm. Did doing this sort of army duty, was it? Did anyone volunteer to do this? Was it good for anyone's career, or was it just basically, wow, you got unlucky, you're being sent out there?
Well, gosh, coming out of West Point, and almost all the officers are,
mm-hmm.
Everybody has studied the same curriculum, and the guys at the top of the class get first choice of which branch they want to go into. So the guys at the top of the class all choose engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, topographic engineers. These are more than just map makers. They really opened the West. It's only 23 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And no enlisted men, all officers.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the topographic engineers, you start looking at cavalry. And then artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, somewhere near the bottom, the infantry.
Yeah.
But if you want to go anywhere in the cavalry, back then it's dragoons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're kind of an elite unit. And they're on the frontier. They're not going to be anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a dragoon, you want to be out here in the frontier.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard. It's a hard life. Typically, you know, you're not going to be on a two-company post.
Mm-hmm.
You can have one company of infantry, one company of dragoons. You know, maybe if you're lucky, two companies of dragoons. Each company is authorized 3 officers. But out of those totals are men on leave, men sick, men who are filling in for higher commanders. There's no retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So the colonel of the regiment is, you know, 60 years old and too sick to serve in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes home on sick leave, and the next guy steps up. And so ultimately you end up with a captain commanding the regiment, and he's not available to command his company.
Hmm.
So one of the lieutenants steps up. Oh gosh. When Bascom was at Fort Buchanan, you've got Colonel Pitcairn Morrison, who is he's a lieutenant colonel and the commander of the 7th Infantry Regiment. Should be a full colonel, but the full colonel's off somewhere else. He's got an adjutant, which has been taken from Company C. The fellow who should have been commanding Company C is now the adjutant. That's sort of a secretary for the commander.
Okay.
You've got Bascom now in command of Company C. You've got, I think, 2 officers in the other company and 1 surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the officers at this post.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've got 1 or 2 ladies at any given time. Plus, each company is authorized 4 laundresses.
Mm-hmm.
And the laundresses, that's a choice position. They do the laundry for the men in the company. They get paid for that.
Mm-hmm.
They get housing and food in addition.
Mm-hmm.
With their own quarters. The NCOs look around and go, hey, this will be a good lady to be my wife.
Right.
You know, otherwise, I don't get quarters. Seriously.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, some of the other ladies decide not to take a permanent husband and take a different one every evening.
Right.
Making additional income.
Oh, yeah. Better than laundry, I would guess.
Not too much.
Yeah. Well,
they got paid fairly well to do the laundry.
Yeah.
So.
So I believe, I'm not sure about this fact, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if there were 4 companies, I guess the fort didn't have the wooden palisades.
Oh, good Lord, no.
But if it were smaller, they did, didn't they?
No, it was... out here in the West, palisades were hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, you know, finding the wood.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Massachusetts had a wooden palisade that was up in what is now southern Colorado. Then it was northern New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I think Fort Defiance might have had a wooden palisade. Fort Cummings had an adobe palisade.
Hmm.
Looks sort of like Fort Zindernoof from the Bo Jest series.
Hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Buchanan was founded by accident. Ewell picked a mesa near the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a good spot. We've got grass. We've got water. And then he got sent away on a campaign against the Apache. Meanwhile, the remaining men and the sickly commander move up to where the post is supposed to be established. The men are apparently at that point in charge of an NCO. They get there and look at it and don't feel like going all the way up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
So they establish the post on the side of the hill.
Yeah.
And it is spread out. I was out there with Doc Fahey, who's been over it. We know other fellows have been over it with metal detectors. And almost a mile from the post headquarters to the quartermaster's building. And it's all open, scattered buildings.
Hmm.
No wall. And part of that is Dragoon thinking. They're going, I'm not going to fight from this place.
Mm-hmm.
I need a place with grass and a place to exercise my horse.
Okay.
And a place for the men to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go fight the enemy over there. Whereas the infantry goes, hey, I need a place I can defend.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this turned out not even to be defensible that way. It was a terrible sight. The top of the hill would have been nice, but they got malaria because they were too close to the stream, and this is malarial country.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like I said, the inspector general came in and looked at it. They built the buildings out of what's known as Hakal,
mm-hmm.
Hacal. And what that is, you drive stakes into the ground vertically and then smear the openings between them with mud. So they had like two or three adobe buildings and the rest of it was Hakal. And the inspector general comes in and says, this looks like a Mexican village. It looked like a fort. Yeah.
So let me ask you about the resources you used for your research. You mentioned some of the documents you used. What sort of stuff have you used for this book?
Well, I love getting into the old newspapers, many of which are now online.
Mm-hmm.
So often we find people writing in to the newspaper and they're printing the whole letter just the way it was written.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get primary accounts. That is first-person accounts coming right out of the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I also have access to microfiche at the Arizona Historical Society in Tucson,
mm-hmm.
Where they've got the records, the mail, and the morning reports, the post returns from the posts in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
as well as the writings of all sorts of different people that have been gifted to the society, to the museum.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone into, for some things, to the county records, looking for, well, with Tom Jeffords, I was able to track down which mines he claimed, which places he'd owned,
mm-hmm.
In the county records.
So on the Mexican side, was there any records from Mexico that would be of any use? You know, any churches or anything like that?
There are some. I've got friends working with those down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they apparently run into some problems. At some point, the Mexican government declared that the Apache don't exist.
Hmm.
And the records of them, a lot of them were destroyed. In other cases, they've got the same sort of things that we're finding up here. Town records, state records like Sonora and Chihuahua,
mm-hmm.
And military records that have been preserved.
Okay. What part of the research has been most enjoyable for you?
Well, you know, I've got to get when I can get first-hand accounts and start reading from somebody that was there,
mm-hmm.
whether it's in a letter in the newspaper or a letter in the archives, you just light up. It's fun to watch how they describe things and the way that they said things.
What did you find, and I know you've been doing this research on this subject for a while, but for this book, what did you find that was most surprising?
It was most surprising. Well, we've been told that Bascom's records were burned when they burned Fort Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody didn't realize that the military forwards their records so that they'd gone on to Fort Union and eventually to Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so finding out that, hey, these still exist was wonderful.
So they were in the National Archives?
Yeah. And that's what I'm getting here on microfiche.
Oh, okay.
The copies that have been made and passed on to the...
Okay. Was there an issue that was particularly difficult for you to research that maybe you don't have a satisfactory answer on, or you did get it, but it took a lot of work?
There are a number of them, and for the most part, it's disagreements between accounts. I found that there are three accounts, one of them, Reuben Bernard, that do not agree with each other. Mm-hmm. And do not agree with any other account. And I've been able to track down histories that went back to Reuben Bernard.
Mm-hmm.
and able to show that he actually knew the guy that gave that report. And, well, anyway, to go on, I found eight primary accounts, some from folks that had been there from the very beginning of the event, from when Bascom left Fort Buchanan, and others. I can look at their arrival dates and go, okay, I understand why you think that didn't happen. You weren't really here. You weren't here yet. Somebody told you about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And most of these, the eight accounts, are so much in agreement, that I'm able to dismiss these minor discrepancies.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites is Bascom's account and Sergeant Robinson's account of their first parley with Cochise after the affair at the tent, when they were coming in to talk about the hostages, and Cochise comes in and says, give me my people back.
Mm-hmm.
And Bascom, well, while they're talking, three of the Overland Mail employees come out of the station, and they're being called by two women over to the Arroyo, where Robinson already knows that there are many Apaches hiding. Bascom tells them to go back. And what's interesting in Bascom's report is that he mentions Wallace and not the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And Robinson, who's standing next to him, mentions the other two and not Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
Wallace gets taken by Cochise. The other two escape, get back to the station. And you know what? How come they don't see all three? But by the next day, it's clear that both of them are fully aware that all three were out there.
Hmm.
So, what can you say for a resolution?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't see them, but it's clear that they knew.
Huh. Yeah, the mysteries of history.
Yeah.
Was there anything you discovered that had an emotional impact on you, either positively or negatively, or even, something amusing, maybe?
Well, I looked into the career of Reuben Bernard and really came to dislike him most heartily.
Hmm.
Reuben Bernard, in 1869, fought against Cochise. On that day, he wrote up citations for 32 Medal of Honor. That was almost every man under his command.
Yeah.
It was implied by some later on that the reason he did this was that he led from the rear.
Oh.
But to me, it just seems like typical Bernard. He got there after a fight. He wasn't expecting trouble. Found himself in a fight. And then tried to blow it up into something that made him look like a hero.
Yeah. So...
Can you imagine 32 Medal of Honor?
No, I can't. It's ridiculous, but it's still very, very funny that someone would try to do that, push that through.
It's different back in those days.
Yeah, I guess so. So what do you hope the book will do?
Oh, I'm hoping, along with some of Bascom's family, to clear his name.
Mm-hmm.
That people will realize that he may not have been perfect, but that he was certainly a lot better man than he was described.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping people take a more realistic approach to the idea that wars start because two people insult each other. Not exactly. You know, it's more complex than that. They start because you get large forces opposing each other. You know, in our case, the westward expansion against Apache raiding.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book finished or published and how you overcame those?
Well, I was really, really lucky. Through a friend, I got introduced to Aaron Turner, who acquires books for Two Dot Press, and was able over dinner to pitch the idea to her. And so I had the book sold before I wrote it.
Oh, nice.
And I was able to tell her I've done most of the research already, so I can knock it out in a few months. Then I got really lucky with another friend. He handed me a book that he put together over the years of reports that he collected and other information. And that was very, very helpful.
And I think you had mentioned your next writing project briefly. Can you mention that again?
Oh, yeah. The next one is Terror on the Santa Fe Trail. Kit Carson, the Hickory Apache.
Okay.
And the Hickory Apache.
Okay. Now, where can people find your books, and where can they find you online?
Well, you can find me at DougHocking.com, and my books are available there. They're also all on Amazon. They're available in Kindle, primarily Kindle. They are also available in many bookstores, and you can get your bookstore to order them.
Can you spell your name for listeners so they know how to get to your website?
Okay, it's Doug, D-O-U-G, Hocking, H-O-C-K-I-N-G.
Okay, cool. So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final words?
No, I hope they'll all read my books. I'm trying to get to a larger and wider audience. Tom Jeffords, friend of Cochise, took two awards this summer. It took Aceper Award and one of the co-founders' awards for Best Western History from Westerners International.
Yeah, it sounds like, this is a very interesting topic, and it sounds like you did some very interesting research and found some really cool documents and stuff to support your work, your research.
It has been fun, and it's been fun writing it up and trying to do it in a way that people find interesting and easy to read.
All right, well, thank you for speaking with me.
I'm glad to do it, Chris.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.